Resonance Rewind. And every so often, some delightful guests from the cosmos. Ooh.
After a severe accident, Cliff Steele wakes up a changed man in the house of Dr. Niles Calder and his Doom Patrol, with Crazy Jane, Rita Farr, Larry Traynor, and Eric Morden. Inevitably, it's time for another exploration into Resonance Rewind.
My name's Dr. Niles Calder. Please nod your head if you can understand me.
So what is this place?
My home. A safe place for you, others like you, to heal. Cliff Steele, Larry Traynor. I thought he might help you with your recovery.
What's your story?
I can't control this thing inside of me. I flew airplanes.
Hold on, there's something up here.
You promised things would change after we moved here. You said there'd be no more late night beers with the guys.
I'm really scared, Cheryl.
Used to do this.
Crash and die, babe.
I love you too, honey.
Around and around. That's it?
I don't know what happened to us. I don't know if you even care how sorry I am. No!
Seeing your daughter, that's good. Just the inspiration you need.
Rita Farr, actress from the 50s.
You were in the movies?
Pictures.
Get rid of it.
But the crew, they adore him.
Then put his name on the marquee.
Get rid of it.
I want to speak to Jane.
Jane's not here, you sissy little pig.
She's in a mood.
Which one of her is in a mood?
Jane is on.
I've got 64 personalities. A group of creepy scientists did terrible things to an innocent girl.
Don't touch me!
Oh, please touch me.
Do you remember what it felt like?
What?
To be normal.
I'm working with some fascinating people. Each one of them is just bursting with potential. Like you, Vic.
Every person I save is me fulfilling a pledge to my mom that she'll never get to hear.
Father and I already discussed it.
Trying to make her proud. Knowing I'm the reason she's not around to see. This is bullshit!
Morden.
I haven't been Mr. Morden since. Yo, help me!
The man is the man!
I'm nobody.
I've been admiring those freaks of yours for quite some time.
Are we really the best people to hunt a supervillain?
Hell no.
You're all at my mercy.
This isn't real.
No matter how hard I hit, where I hit, what I hit, I can't feel pain.
You're as afraid as the rest of us.
You're kidding me!
This is what the world looks like when we try to live in it.
We don't have to get involved. Especially if we make things worse.
I want to go home.
We can do that.
I don't even know what to hope for.
I'm powerless. I have no clue how to fix this.
Hey, Dad.
This mission you're on is your mission.
Every criminal we bust, every person we save, is us.
Chief said his enemies were coming for him.
Don't worry. We got this.
Now comes the reckoning!
What do you want from me?
Yes! I am ready, Father!
Holy! Holy! Holy!
I got the point!
Don't you dare hurt them.
They are quite doomed.
Thank God that's solved. Mint juleps.
So what are the team going to make of Doom Patrol? The pilot episode, of course, still going strong into its fourth season now, directed by Glenn Winter, written by Arnold Drake, Bob Haney, and indeed Bruno Premiani. Those of us of a certain age, of course, vintage, remember the original Doom Patrol comic book, and of course the incarnation of Grant Morrison in the early part of the 21st century, in which these characters effectively emerge as the kind of anti X-Men in many ways. But enough of such meanderings. Let's turn straight away to Victoria Simmons. Victoria, what did you make of Doom Patrol Episode 1 without any profanities, please? Obviously, because this is a broadcast show.
I thought it was a lot to take in. It seemed to have a lot of different characters that you needed to get used to and different ideals. And it took me a while, actually, to work out what was going on.
Yeah, we have that introduction to, of course, the character of Cliff Steele, clearly not painted as a hero in any way, shape or form, a somewhat philandering individual and racing driver and so on. And I think this is one of the key aspects, that they all have flaws. I mean, Rita Farr, of course, the unfortunate actress who lands in terms of some toxic waste in a river while she's on location and effectively loses all her controls. I mean, that was one of the most piquant moments, I thought, of the episode, where when she's effectively in the town and she just says, I want to go home. And on one level, we all basically want to go home. And I thought there was an interesting line there. I mean, this is part of the Arrowverse. It's part of Greg Berlanti's ever-expanding DC television empire. As you said, a lot to go on, certainly focusing on three of the key characteristics that we see there. We mentioned, obviously, Cliff Steele. We'd talked about Rita Farr as well. We've also, of course, got Larry Traynor, who is portrayed by Matt Bomer. One of my favourite characters, of course, Niles Calder, who I think at this particular stage, you're not sure, is he a good guy? Is he a mad scientist? Is he a problematic thing? I mean, we just hear the voice of Eric Morden, played by Alan Tudyk, in terms of how that operates. Did it work for you as an opener? Does it kind of invite you to actually watch more? Do you feel as though these are characters that, you know, let's not forget Crazy Jane, Diane Guerrero, can't even say the word really. I like to call on one of my other 64 characteristics there. Or is it one of those things where you sort of think, I just don't know. I just don't know where they're going here. It's crazy.
I did think a little bit about that, about I'm not entirely sure where it's going because there is so much information, but there are lots of different elements of the characters that I think, okay, I'd like to know more about Crazy Jane. And she says she has 64 personalities. So that's intriguing. What could that bring in the future?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we talk about characteristics, and for those folk who would say, well, superheroes, they're all passé, they've all gone from that point of view. I mean, we're certainly talking about not A-list superheroes here. Many people did say that this was a kind of precursor to the X-Men done by DC from that side of things there. And of course, the classic line that, you know, they're stuck in Doom Manor, They visit the local town while the chief is away. And, you know, again, I suppose you've also got the flatulent donkey, which is probably just worth watching the second episode for, just to actually see what happens with the flatulent donkey. And, of course, the way in which the oracle of wisdom caused by the flatulence in the donkey kind of emerges into a whole range of things. I suspect you never even in your wildest dreams thought of writing an ode to a flatulent donkey as one of your song titles.
No. There are, of course, lots of songs in Shrek about a donkey. So,
this is true, of course. Perhaps not to the extent of what happens to the digestive system of this donkey. But no spoilers on that particular side of things there. Let's talk music. I mean, we get a mixture of sounds coming across from classic tracks, from areas that have been woven in together with, obviously, the soundtrack that's actually there within that areas of experience, etc. Echo and the Bunnymen, People Are Strange, being one example of a classic 1990s, I think, or maybe, yes, no, it was all 1990s, a number that's actually there. Did you feel that actually worked to actually keep the themes going? And it does jump around pretty much from where we're going. I mean, we also had another number, which again, I remember, but I suspect you, if I said the words Toto Coelho, you would actually think, I've never ever heard of I Eat Cannibals. What were they about? In many ways, they kind of out Spice Girls 10 years before the Spice Girls actually were in place, basically.
No, I've never heard of that. But it's interesting music, but it's a lot of music. But that's like the characters. There's a lot of characters. There's a lot of information. There's a lot of music going on with that. So
just looking through the soundtrack, we've got in addition to I Ate Cannibals and People Are Strange, we've got Fox on the Run, which was put together by The Sweet, known probably for their classics Blockbuster and Ballroom Blitz. We had, of course, Billy Idol singing Rebel Yell. Love Can Hurt by Shanana. And of course, the classic Cool and the Gang, Not Celebrate, Good Times Were Hey, But Fresh. So, you know, lots of stuff there, which again, probably owes a lot to what James Gunn does with Guardians of the Galaxy, insofar as you have classic tracks from pop charts of the 20th century woven into the narrative. So they're actually, you know, part of the experience.
But of course, the amount of music that going in and the different styles also represents the different information and styles of each character. So,
yep, absolutely. And again, that opens up a whole range of things there. Okay, let's talk characters. You mentioned the C word there, and I know there's a lot of profanity on this, and I would actually put the advisory that if people are sort of saying, ooh, Doom Patrol, as covered on Resonance Rewind, we'll just screen that for our 9-year-old's child, basically. Be careful. It's not really one which I think younger viewers would effectively be necessarily taken aback with. I mean, you could argue that they could easily do a version which would be age-friendly and age-appropriate. But the very notion that, again, on the, I think we're talking about an 18 certificate here. Certainly, if you're concerned about how nannies and racing drivers actually bond, maybe you want to step away from this side of things there. But let's talk about those characters. And I mean, are there any characters that you think, yeah, you know, I'd quite like to hang out with Crazy Jane, or indeed maybe the character of Larry Traynor?
No, I do like Crazy Jane, just to see what she would be coming out with all the time. She'd keep you on your toes.
As indeed she did with the Robot Man and Cliff Steele. But again, that's something else from that point of view. Any honourable mentions then in terms of the cast list?
I think, yeah, probably Rita Farr. She just seems as though she's gone from the top of her game, being a beautiful star, to suddenly losing everything and almost melts down, literally, which is quite sad.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, I wasn't familiar with the actress, April Bowlby, who takes on board the role of Rita Farr, but she certainly seems to address all the key areas there. And in many ways, again, you've got the metaphor for the fickleness of fame, the encounter that she actually has in the cafe in the town, where she's obviously very flattered initially by the owner of the cafe, until of course, you know, she starts getting the shock of maybe her image has been used without her consent for various adult activities, and that effectively starts off the trigger of shock and fear and concern that obviously leads to literally the blob emerging, and of course the destruction that actually follows that.
Yeah, I think it's quite an interesting concept of going from one extreme to another. And that's pretty much the same with all of them, really, because they've got their lives that they've been living, something has happened and they've gone completely the other way. And trying to find themselves in the middle somewhere is very difficult for all of them.
Yeah. Well, find out what the rest of the team thinks in the fullness of time after we've had another popular musical break, of course, featured on Doom Patrol. But I take it that you're going for Crazy Jane as your favourite character. Is that definite, or is there one that you wish? I mean, are you going to secretly say, no, end of the day, it's got to be the donkey?
No, it's got to be Crazy Jane. She's someone you can really resonate with, I think.
Ideal. And a way of actually reinforcing the programme title, which is great. So what about that wonderful, challenging aspect of trying to quantify the qualitative? What is your score out of 10 going to be for the first episode of Doom Patrol?
I think I'm actually going to take it down from what other people may say. Not that I know right now, but I was going for a 7.5 because it is quite a lot and you have to really concentrate. And for me, sometimes movies like that, quite a few of the Marvel movies have got so much action coming at me that I get a bit confused.
I'm also hovering around the 7.5. I might possibly nudge it up to 8. We'll see as the program actually develops. It's not by any means, I think, a perfect piece. Again, as people who regularly follow my views with respect to Richard Fitzwilliams on our weekly movie slots will know, I'm never a great one where they have extreme profanity and indeed likewise bodily functions. And obviously we got both of those in here. Having said all of that, there is one particular line which is uttered by Crazy Jane, where she effectively tells Rita Farr where to go, which I found laugh out loud in so many ways. And again, it worked. And I think within that context of the genre of Doom Patrol and the comic book world, yeah, it might nudge you up to an 8, currently sitting on 7.5. So, Victoria, we will catch up with you for the next Resonance Rewind and indeed Midweek Drive Live. Thanks for that. And here's Echo and the Bunny Man. People are strange when we're strangers. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. We'll be right back.
when you scream. No one remembers your name when you scream. When you scream. When you scream.
I won't be gone long, but there are mysterious things in this world that bear keeping an eye on. So go I must. Profound words, almost as profound as those which Phil Leonis would probably love to actually address in oh so many ways. Phil Leonis, welcome back to Resonance Rewind. You've been keeping an eye on mysterious things in the world, clearly. What are your thoughts on the pilot episode of a series that's still going when it comes to, obviously, DC doing DP?
Okay, I'm going to have to start there at the end, which is always such a good place to begin, especially if you are seemingly omniscient, like the Alan Tudyk character in the show. It is not still going. I just read that the fourth season was the final season, as it turns out. And even if it had not been, I really fear with the labor situation the way that it is, that it would have suffered from what we call force majeure, which sounds like a DC supervillain to me. But nevertheless, Alex, I was so excited about this. This is the second time in a matter of weeks that you have turned me on to a show that maybe this time I had heard of it. But I can also conflate that very easily with having heard of the comics. I was not aware of anything really of substance about this show. And it has a fascinating kind of a trajectory, at least here in the States, about how it reached audiences. It was on a short-lived streaming service, I think a DC streaming service that was later then merged in with the larger HBO and now Max. And I feel like this is a show that both in terms of what it deserves, but also in terms of, you know, the availability of its platform now, may only end up finding its full audience after the fact. Does that make sense?
Did you like it, Phil, in terms of the actual piece?
Well, that's why I said in terms of what it deserves. I mean, am I wrong? It didn't seem like this made a huge ripple in terms like the way that The Boys did, or, you know, which I think there's some similarities to over there on Amazon. But at least on the basis of the pilot, wow, there is some fascinating work being done. Never mind just entertaining. This is a show that seems to have satirically a lot on its mind and emotionally a lot going on in its heart. I could leap into this in so many different places, but I would like you to drive this particular car because, again, this is absolutely my first experience with the show. And I will maybe, I don't know, spoiler alert, having watched the pilot, I can now honestly say I am looking forward to seeing a second episode.
Which is good. Of course, when you refer to driving the car, I'm not the kind of driver Cliff Steele was, as played by Brendan Fraser, because that would be crazy. Even though Niles does say he's not a monster. He's seen other monsters and he's not a monster from that point of view. There are indeed lots of levels that I found in this aspect, Phil. And like yourself, probably being of a certain vintage, do recall the comics line from DC Comics, where I think Metal Men also had similarities with Doom Patrol. Doom Patrol, of course, arguably the precursor to Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's X-Men, because it actually emerged before they came up with the wheelchair-bound paternal figure and the band of dysfunctional superheroic individuals.
So I don't know. Again, you would know better than I, but I was aware, obviously, of, this feels like a DC equivalent of an X-Men, one, you know, not knowing which came first. But what's fascinating is you saying that this iteration of that concept comes first, then X-Men. And yet, I think we both would agree that visually in this show, they are certainly playing on our awareness of the X-Men movies in terms of how the house, the facility looks. There are some moments visually that seem intentionally to evoke the X-Men of the movies.
Yeah, I think that certainly goes without saying, although you could say that they're simply redressing the balance in terms of how the X-Men borrowed very much from the original incarnation, which I've been wading through some of the Silver Age aspects. And talking of Silver Age, we're delighted that we've got our very own superheroine from New York back with us after she'd had one or two superheroic experiences of her own. Is your hand better, Pamela? Have you managed to recover from your fall?
I actually have to go see a hand specialist. But you know, do you know? I don't know. I think maybe the universe is telling me that I should not have written a song about dancing in the supermarket, because I actually slipped in the supermarket.
I did point that out, but that's another show for another time, and we haven't got the Doom Patrol to actually really address that, especially when you've actually got donkeys who suffer from flatulence and, of course, utter the immortal words that the mind is the limit. Pamela, share with us, what did you make of this edition of Doom Patrol, the pilot episode, of course?
Well, I could be very much a creature of the times we're in. No pun intended, creature. That was my subconscious making a joke. Because I liked it. I mean, the interesting, because I was thinking of all these things as I was watching it. And I have to admit, I did fast forward during over a few bits because I didn't have enough time to really watch it in real time and then come on to this.
It's the challenge of the post-COVID age, Pam. Obviously, you know? We used to have time. Now we no longer have that time.
We're making up for it. So because there's this new, and I know Phil, you could speak to this very verbosely.
Eloquently. I think you mean eloquently and insightfully and perhaps inspirationally.
Here's the thing. I think that we are personifying we're giving so much emotional and psychological attention to our superheroes now. You know, what's their backstory? What are their traumas? What you know, how are they feeling emotionally? We're giving so much to them that it never used to be that way. And so the interesting thing is, you know, I have to say I do kind of care about that, but at the same time, it doesn't shy away from certain things. And it was pretty racy and risque and a little more woke and that kind of thing. So I have to say that that kind of drew me in because it was modern. And I was able to watch it because it ticked those boxes. Obviously, it was done really well. It was cast really well. The actors are very strong. They have a mega, mega, mega budget to make everything look great and sound great, you know.
So, I had not thought of what Pamela just said,
really?
And it just made my head explode because, Alex, I think you've heard me talk about this before, about how when we were younger, right, DC Comics, these characters were not necessarily in Doom Patrol, but across the board, DC was much more popular than Marvel. And when the Marvel movies started to get made, the general consensus in Hollywood was, these are B-level characters. Nobody's going to care about them like they do Batman and Superman. And instead, Marvel was far more popular. And when I looked at why, because you can always cherry pick from a film here and there, like, okay, well, it's the sense of humor. It's this, the approach, all of which plays a part. But writ large, what came across to me was a fundamental difference thematically, which was in Marvel, that which wounds these characters is what heals them. The from a spider bite to a busted heart on down the line. Whereas in the DC universe of characters, the wounding remains a vulnerability forever. It's something to be hidden. It's something to be literally locked away in a subterranean cave as we put on a mask and hide who we are out in the world. And we had gotten to this point, I think, culturally, where from 9/11, wars, you know, whatever the collective trauma we've suffered is, we would like to believe as people that not only do our woundings matter, but that we get stronger in the broken places. And this DC iteration in Doom Patrol, oh my goodness, does this finally get that message that that's what we want to see? Think about a woman who has personality disorder, multiple personality disorder, and that's a superpower, not a weakness. We all feel that we have multiple personality disorder at times. And so anyway, that you're absolutely right, Pamela, on two scores. That is remarkable about this. And two, I was verbose.
You did not disappoint.
So, Pamela, looking at the way the whole sequence went, and again, echoing what Phil has just said there, the taped message that, of course, Cliff Steele listens back to himself. I don't know what happened to her, so I'm going to be better. I mean, very much a flawed individual. I mean, the fact that he ends up as a robot man and his name is Cliff Steele is, again, an interesting line from that perspective. Perhaps not so much with Larry Traynor and certainly Rita Farr, who obviously would view herself as being a star in also many ways. Did you feel from that perspective, and we're not going to select favorite characters as yet, any of them that particularly connected with yourself?
Maybe from a pure ego point of view, the old Hollywood starlet, although I never was one. she just was so, it was like such a time, and not necessarily who she really was, but who they painted her to be, and that whole idea of that, that thing to which maybe women aspired to at a certain time, to be that sort of Hollywood glamour puss. And even it just is this sort of romantic old Hollywood ideal, and there's magic in it, even if it's a total fabrication. And now we all know that no one was that good. I mean, maybe Audrey Hepburn, but I don't know. And anyway, so I would say, and plus, she was just, the actress has such a beautiful face and those doe eyes, like you just want to stare at her the whole time. So, I mean, I don't quite understand, and maybe it's because I fast forwarded, but I don't quite understand what happened to her to turn her into that sort of elephant.
She accidentally fell into a toxic pool whilst filming a movie, which obviously impacted on her whole side of things, which may have been the revenge of her very negative view on differently abled individuals, one of whom was actually the camera puller.
Karma is a beep. Yeah. It's a karmic kind of thing. But honestly, like, so talk. So now I want to really get inside of this. It was a toxic pool back then, and it didn't just kill her. It transformed her skin. I mean, was it like kind of like, what do you call it? Uranium sort of, kind of situation.
there is a horrible joke in here, dark joke metaphor, but we have seen both men and women stars at the end of their life, and we look at them and we wonder what happened. Not because of aging, but because of, like, the portrait of Dorian Gray is how these people look. And the obvious reference here is because they all dived in to the pool of toxicity that is Hollywood, that is the image machine. And this is what that portrait, you become your portrait that's locked away in the closet, I think. Anyway, that's what I took it. I took it as. Yeah. Yeah.
Again, I think a appropriate metaphor, given that everything before the butt is baloney, to quote one of Rita Farr's lines that she put into place. I did feel, as I shared earlier with Victoria, that so the most laugh out loud moment for me was the first encounter that we see between, or at least on screen, between Rita Farr and Crazy Jane, And Crazy Jane's somewhat abrupt response to the greeting that Rita was trying to reach out and go for. Because there is this sense that they're all trying to reach out, even the journey where they go against the views of the chief, their paternal creator, if you like, and take that school bus into town and ends in that tragedy, which leads to obviously the Rita Farr blob effectively saying, I want to go home. But they still actually kind of go through that whole notion. And again, as the narrator would say, by Mr. Nobody, portrayed by Alan Tudyk, ultimately it's a case of zeros still trying to actually make some kind of impact on life. Maybe, again, echoing the human condition. Or is that too simplistic a reading? I mean, Phil, let's talk characters with respect to yourself. So far, I think Pamela's gone for Rita Farr. Victoria actually was a very keen follower of Crazy Jane. I quite liked the incarnation of Timothy Dalton's version of the Professor Niles. But from your own point of view, who stood out? Who would you like to find more about? Who would you like to have a beer with or a suitable non-alcoholic beverage?
Well, I'm going to run through a little litany here because I had such a fascinating experience with each of them where there was a moment where each of them was my favorite. Not as a cop-out, but I mean, the one that was the least was, you know, the one that for me evokes memories of Claude Rains as the Invisible Man. But boy, that moment of he always felt like he was a monster because of what he kept hidden, and it was what was in his heart. I mean, how does that not affect you? And in that moment, again, we are him. Timothy Dalton, I've always been a huge admirer of. So, of course, I love what he's doing. I think it's wonderful casting. I love the career that he's had and the choices that he's made. Brendan Fraser was eye-opening for me because I had thought that The Whale was such a huge comeback for him and did not realize, one, that he had been working and that he'd been doing very good work, as it turns out. He hadn't disappeared, so I don't understand why I, of all people, was led to believe he had. For me, this idea of discovering something new is always, you know, really worthwhile. And Diane Guerrero gets, I think, the most interesting things to do. She does them in unexpected ways, and I knew nothing of her. Had to research her and then find out that, well, she's done many, many things, none of which I have watched, including Orange is the New Black. I never watched that show. The irony being that one of my wife's very best friends created that show and we still have never watched it. But now, because of Diane Guerrero, I am going to watch that show. So I would say that at this point, after one episode, this would be where my greatest interest lies.
There was a wonderful shot-for-shot recreation of the original Grant Morrison 1990s comic book, where we see the sequence where Cliff Steele is endeavouring to connect with Crazy Jane, and she's painting outside, and the rain starts falling down, and she's the hangman's daughter. And that is literally almost taken. It's a shot-by-shot recreation of the graphic narrative. If you look at that back in the 1990s. When Grant Morrison was effectively reinventing the classic DC universe from the Silver Age of the 1960s, when, of course, Doom Patrol first emerged.
Well, maybe you can hip us to a little bit of historic context. I was fascinated when The Watchmen was turned into an HBO series, a magnificent HBO series, even though, of course, the creator of the comic did not approve of it, but
Alan
he has
Moore
never...
doesn't like anything that's made in a filmic version.
No, he doesn't like anything. I mean, he would not approve of us drawing breath, I don't think, let alone redrawing his characters. But in all honesty, a fantastic graphic novel series is turned into a superb television series by finding new relevancy, and not just new relevancy for right now, but a relevancy that was set almost 100 years ago on Black Wall Street. So just a wonderful bit of reinvention. And I'm wondering, just, you know, without spoiling anything, the historic perspective. Why did the comic series Doom Patrol matter, if we can say that it did? And how does this pilot episode either reflect or change that or reinvent it?
My initial feeling is it relates to Greg Berlanti, who very much has been the leader, together with Geoff Johns, of DC's huge range of programs post-Smallville, which we've also covered in terms of past Resonance Rewinds, when, of course, the Arrow series led to the invention of the Arrowverse with various high-profile series such as Supergirl emerging. And this, together with Stargirl, was one of those, again, attempts to really flag up the breadth of the universe and continue to develop it. And yes, as I say, four seasons, it's reasonable. It's a reasonable shout. And I think has had that longevity and does, in a real sense, despite the fact that I would say, once again, as a caveat, if you're thinking, oh, superhero series, we'll screen it for the whole family. It's not a family friendly show as such. There's an awful lot of F-bomb dropping and such like material where I think you have to be very careful of that. But having said that, in terms of actually appreciating it as a commentary on the human condition and seeing the serious side of graphic narratives, I think it works. Pamela, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, it occurs to me that there's so many levels that one could see this on. You know, if you have a historical perspective and you know, excuse me, certain, what do they call them, Easter eggs, or references to things that are very inside, and the more you know it, it's giving you something and you're like, yeah, they're giving a nod to that and they're doing the recreating this thing. And like for me, it's like, whoa, no, I like none of that registers because I don't really know anything outside of basic pop songwriting, you know, like construction, you know, anything else just sort of woo, goes right over my head. But on a very fundamental level, like for someone who likes quirk and edge and unexpected stuff, I have to say that this particular show gave me that because I couldn't have predicted most of what happened. And it makes me want to watch it more because I want to know, like, I want to know these secrets and these stories, and there's more to it, and they leave you with that. But they don't... They're not dumbing down the audience, and I appreciate that too. They're not thinking that we're all morons and they have to just spell things out for us. So I like that as well. And I it's interesting that something that is that big budget could also have an edge to it. And I applaud that.
Well, certainly the next two in the season, for season one, Donkey Patrol, in which the team effectively enter into the donkey in a most unusual way, thanks to Rita Farr. And of course, Puppet Patrol, in which again we see a range of other things happening in the interesting world of Fuketopia, which obviously has a different spelling in all sorts of ways, but it ties and references the character of Sturmführer Fuchs that we heard in the initial thing. It all seems to tie back to Nazis in so many ways, but maybe that's another trope that comes out of the golden age of the comic book superhero and how that was being developed. I won't mention that Cyborg obviously does appear in the second episode because it would be pointless, but I just have. Anyway, Phil, in terms of a score out of 10, Victoria earlier went for a 7.5 out of 10. I'm kind of hovering around about that range as well. I don't think it's necessarily a perfect number, although it's always good to have any show that has Toto Coelho, I Eat Cannibals, Billy Idol, Rebel Yell, and what we've also heard on the show today, Echo and the Bunny Men, People Are Strange in the soundtrack.
Echo and the Bunny Men?
It's the moment basically where the team are effectively walking back into the whole sequence and we have People Are Strange there.
Doors.
I thought it was the Doors recording. Yeah.
Doors. Because,
yeah.
In which case, I think it's Echo and the Bunny Men. However,
sugar? No, I'm gonna have to check that out. I'm gonna have to fact check.
IMDb may be incorrect. That's all I'm saying.
Probably.
I mean, that is interesting. He may be right, but it's fascinating because I really did. I was saying out loud to myself while watching it as that happened. I went, okay, I like this. I like this. Meaning the show, and my wife just called out thinking I was speaking to her because I was speaking out loud. She goes, the Doors? Yeah, they're kind of a big deal. But Echo and the Bunnymen. So we know which license fee is cheaper.
There you go. They could have just redone the song with a completely unknown band. It would have been even cheaper.
Did you ask me what I gave it? Or did we ask Pamela first?
We asked Pamela. Pamela, have you settled on a score?
Oh, no, you didn't ask me yet. But you know what? I'll give you a score. I think a 9. And it's only because I can't definitively give it a 10 yet because I didn't watch it in totality. So I'm going to keep watching it. But the question is, do I go back and spend an hour of my life rewatching
Pamela, it? To quote Lily Leonis and Phil Leonis in one of the trailers for this show, there are so many great TV shows and movies out there. Thank goodness for Resonance Rewind, where we can sift through these aspects and so on. Anyway, Phil, your score.
Now, after quoting Lily and I, sadly, Pamela will not have enough time to rewatch it. I would say an 8. I mean, it's tough. It's a pilot, you know, it's a first episode and there's some heavy lifting that has to be done. And you're kind of aware of the machinations that they have to go through in order to get where they're going. You're aware of it. It's a little bit of counting off instead of actually dancing, you know? So rare is a pilot episode where you say this as a standalone is just perfect. Mm. So that's it. 8, I give it because that gives the show room to grow, but not because there's anything wrong with it. It is what it is, and it does it exceptionally well.
And I may well be moving into that particular zone myself. Next week, we actually get out the yellow swimming trunks and actually have an investigation with Mr. Schubert at the bottom of the ocean as he tries to actually take over the globe in a pathological manner, because we're discovering a being that's been washed up on the shores of the Pacific coast who effectively has gills in place of lungs. Yes, of course, it's Patrick Duffy's opening sequence, The Man from Atlantis. Phil, you have a special teaser for this.
Oh, my goodness. I was with the actor who played The Man from Atlantis just a few nights ago at a bar he owns where I was drinking like a fish.
Underwater? Is the bar underwater?
I was.
There's Patrick Duffy, who probably prefers to be known as Bobby Ewing from the series Dallas. But no, his opening sequence, very much the whole essence.
How much did I drink? Maybe so much that I mistakenly referred to him as Manimal when I meant Man from Atlantis, of course. Manimal, a different thing. Simon McCorkindale, I believe.
Yes, exactly. Yes. A human being who would change and metamorphose into an animal, which again may well occur in future Resonance Rewinds. But no, next week we'll be looking at the opening sequence for Man from Atlantis. But for the moment, to Victoria Simmons earlier, to Pamela Suman, and of course to Phil Leonis, I would say, Phil, almost back to the days of when we had cultural influencers and cultural...
Culture shapers.
Cultural shapers. It's been awesome. And of course, keep watching those movies. No, that's the line I use with Richard Fitzwilliams. I'll say the line for this one, which is, keep on resonating.
7-Eleven.